When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Thank you for downloading this Intelligence Squared podcast. For more information on our debates, talks, and discussions, visit intelligencesquared.com and sign up to the newsletter.
Thank you, Hannah, and thanks to all of you for coming out on this stormy night. Not quite Hurricane Sandy, but still rainy, and so we're very grateful that you're all here. Welcome. We've got, I hope, a very feisty lineup ready for you, ready and eager to go. And as always with Intelligence Squared, our hosts have come up with a tremendously timely topic with just, 8 days to go till the American election. We have that subject before us, the American presidential election. But coming at it from a rather unusual angle, the subject before us is, or the motion before us, Jesus would have voted Democrat. Now, again, for having a pre-election debate, you would do that here if it was a British election that was looming. But you almost certainly wouldn't come up with a motion like this. In British politics, we tend to avoid talking about religion in polite company. Tony Blair famously declared, or Alistair Campbell famously declared, interrupting Tony Blair as he was about to answer a question about his faith, "We don't do God." He reminded his nominal boss that not to go there. But in America, and in American politics, utterly relevant, if not even somewhere central to how an American election is conducted. I learned this myself as a correspondent in the United States when I would notice quite discreet buttons, badges, here that would have the initials WWJD. What would Jesus do? And those buttons were replaced often, actually. You would see instead WWRD, what would Reagan do? Which is a kind of heretical and blasphemous thought. But tonight, the question we're asking really is, what would Jesus do? How would he cast his vote? So that's this question before us. And as I say, four people really excellent, expertly placed to debate that. I'm going to offer a word of defensive Guardian columnist apology on their behalf in advance, a preemptive strike, which is to apologise that none of them are women. And in fact, you have a panel of and chair of five white men. That is, now here's the logical conundrum for you. Of course, all our panellists are always our first choice, but it was also the case that there was quite a strong effort, strenuous effort, to get some female contributors to this panel. But unfortunately, all of them were unavailable. But nevertheless, as you know, we have got, of course, our dream panel right here. So you work out how to square those propositions. I'm not going to do it for you. But I wanted to get that in advance just in case anyone felt moved to point it out. So let's get on with proceedings. You will already have seen this unusual ballot paper. Usually for Intelligence Squared events, it's a straightforward up and down motion, yes or no. You either agree with the motion before you or you disagree. This time you have four different options in Florida-style ballot paper here. I will be personally coming to be examining your hanging chads afterwards, a nice 2000 reference that dates me. I can tell some younger members don't know what I'm referring to. But if it's a dead heat, then we will have to examine these closely. It's a paper ballot with our four options. Would Jesus have voted Democrat, Republican? Would he have been a swing voter? Or would he have backed neither main party? Consider that fourth option the none of the above option. So that's your ballot paper. You'll hear the four speeches, you'll hear much of the debate from the floor. At around the time when our four speakers give their closing summing up remarks, That's when our tellers will be coming round to collect your ballot. So please listen closely to the closing remarks, but some of you will already have voted by the time you hear them. A slight defect in this, as in every democracy, I'm afraid. So that's the process. I will have a... You've all been voting as you came in. I'll have the result of that, that non-binding indicative ballot. I'll have that once our four speakers have finished. They all each have a maximum of 12 minutes each. At 10 minutes, I will impolitely strike my glass once. At 11 minutes, I will strike it twice. And at 12 minutes, a thunderbolt will come out of the sky to punish them in appropriately biblical fashion for going on too long. So I will introduce each of our panellists, starting... I won't say whether it's appropriate or not. On the far left, the former Canon Chancellor of St Paul's Cathedral, a colleague of mine on The Guardian, previously chaplain of Wadham College, Oxford, a frequent broadcaster, author, columnist, and contributor really to the public realm, and a familiar voice on Radio 4's Today programme, where some of you may have enjoyed him taking Richard Dawkins to the cleaners, Giles Fraser. Yes, I know. I'm introducing the whole panel first. There was some fear that I thought Giles was going first, but he's not. Don't worry. I'm introducing the whole panel first. On my immediate left, if the Church of England used to be described as the Tory party at prayer, our next speaker is perfectly placed to judge perhaps some both of those institutions, hugely influential in the Conservative conversation and Conservative debate, the editor of the Conservative Home website, and Conservative activist, former Chief of Staff for Ian Duncan Smith when he was the leader of the Conservative Party, and regular contributor across the press, and recently, I think, voted Political Commentator of the Year at the Comment Awards, hugely influential, Tim Montgomery. On my immediate right here is the visiting senior research fellow at King's College London and an associate professor of international political studies at Richmond University in London. You'll have seen him around the place commenting on American politics and with ever more frequent media appearances as we get closer to Election Day. In fact, the election passing will be bad for business for our next speaker, but frequently on BBC News and Sky News, and recently the author of What's So Extraordinary About Rendition in the International Journal of Human Rights. Our next and third speaker, Dr. James Boyes. And completing our panel, the Professor of Human Rights Law at LSE, a former legal currently legal correspondent for the Catholic magazine The Tablet, previously a lecturer at the University of Cambridge, author of many, many books and a frequent broadcaster as well. Completing our panel, Conor Gearty. So there we are. So that's our speakers, and we will go in straight away to the person advancing the case or advance in the motion that Jesus would have voted Democrat. Please to take the podium, Conor Gearty.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm glad you resisted the temptation to replace yourself with a woman, Chair. Because I think it was very wise of us to mimic the power of the Church in the composition of our panel. And there's a point there about what we're voting for. We're voting on a question about a person who happens to many people to be the Son of God, Son of Man, as he called himself. We're not voting about a church. And we're not voting about our own interests. We're not going to commit the crime so tempting to identify what our own preconceptions are about the world and then to describe those as the preconceptions of Jesus Christ. So the fact that, for example, my good friend Giles Fraser, not often to be heard on that well-known radio program, what is it called again? The Immoral Haze, the Moral Bays. The fact that he might take a certain view of Christianity, which might lead him to heroic and brave decisions, is not necessarily the views of Jesus. And we need to carefully separate out our own personal engagement from the person we're discussing. So you won't be able to hear me because of some ludicrous defect in the system which makes Florida look like a proper constitutional framework of government. You won't be able to hear me until after you've voted in the wind-up, which might not have been a wind-up. So I'm asking you to remember, as you cast your vote on the proper occasion, waiting for my sum-up, not able to hear it, you're not actually imposing your own prejudices. You are thinking about a person. And that's a really important preliminary remark, actually. Now, what do we know about this person? You'll remember that my job, there's nothing behind us. This magnificent place is contemptuous of modern technology, which means I have to try and remember what the debating motion is. I normally rely on, yeah, well, anything other than Sir Thomas More and his family.
Holbein.
After Hans Holbein. I have no idea what that means. Perhaps they were running after Hans Holbein. What do we know about this guy that leads me to believe that he would have voted Democrat? Were he alive? Arguably, of course, alive but elsewhere. Well, first of all, he was early on displaying a degree of political style, actually. He was hanging around with his cousin. Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser will correct me if I'm wrong. I believe this chap who goes by the name of John was his cousin.
Could be.
Could be his cousin. And he got baptized, and he thought, I can do this better. I can do this better. And he engaged then in a kind of trumping of the cousin in what I would call a kind of spiritual Milibandic move. And then we all know what happened to John, and I'm not sure whether or not the Moral Maze could address it, but the field was left clear. And we don't even know, you know, so we know that he got into this thing, ministry. We don't really know. The Gospels, I think, are a bit confused about how long. We all seem to think 3 years, maybe 1 year, according to one of them, the late guy John, the other John. Where, we're not even sure where. We know he ended up in Jerusalem. We can be pretty sure that we have a sort of idea of what he was talking about. Is that an intervention by a celestial? Is it turned off? Because we have access to these extraordinary, relatively reliable records in the form of the Gospels, in that they are the reduction of an oral tradition to writing quite early on, at least three of them. And what Dermot McCullough, the very distinguished historian of Christianity, sums them up as, these parables, these interventions, these discussions, as the following quote. Remember, we're thinking about who would he vote for. Whatever you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. Now, most religions around this time were producing something not dissimilar. Whatever you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. A moral code. Immanuel Kant, much, much later, thought he was ditching religion and came up with the same thing. It's rooted in empathy. It's rooted in this idea that you feel others and the pain of others, and you see others and you understand others. Not just reason, it's feeling as well. Now, the contemporary version of such a person would be, I think, and would argue, and we can discuss it, a human rights worker. Somebody who gives up the opportunities that life has thrown them in financial, career, professional terms and reaches out to the asylum seeker, the immigrant. You can wonder which of the parties that sort of person would vote for. Now, it's one thing to say that about Jesus Christ, it's another thing to say he would vote Democrat, and I'm going to push that, because that's a big claim. I appreciate that. I have to show, first, what he said about society, secondly, what he did about what he said, and thirdly, why it would be Democrat and not Republican. What he said about society, I've already anticipated. The most famous one is the Sermon on the Mount. You know it well. Apparently, according to Luke, it was a sermon on the plain. Wouldn't have taken off in the same way, would it? Sermon on the plain. P-L-A-I-N. Miracles not yet at that level. And we know what he said. The kingdom of God is for the poor, the hungry, the widely hated. We know from Matthew, he said, repeating the golden rule that McCulloch recovered for us in summary a moment ago, love your neighbour as yourself. We know too from Matthew, if you would be perfect, go sell what you possess and give to the poor, and you will have treasure. You will have treasure in heaven. We know from Luke, but when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. We know from Luke, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. So we can show a guy, having, as it were, bumped off his cousin, moving around the place and arguing for the outcast. And then the really big question, the second of the two, of the three, what did he do about it? This is an important point, because maybe all he did was that. Maybe all he did was existentially involve himself in sort of preaching, and you bump into a guy on the way to the temple, and there he is, and you say, very charming and interesting, like a Guardian editorial, and you ignore it. Sorry, Jonathan. But no, I'm going to argue that actually he shows us political activism. The most famous and obvious example is, of course, his attack on the temple for the misuse, for commerce, and for profit. An attack that led directly to his death as after having been a political prisoner. A political assassination for having destabilized the status quo. As he said, quoting Matthew, you cannot serve both God and money. Is it significant that he chose the Passover period to engage in this challenging conduct, conduct that was to lead to his death, a period in which the Jewish people, and he was Jewish, celebrate a political liberation from Egypt? Look at the early church, committed to equality, so completely opposed to property that the idea of ownership was beyond them, and that lingered in the church through to medieval period, where it was regarded as defensible to take, that the needy could take. But mainly, and this is really the central point I want you to get from this, mainly, this idea that he was saying all the rules have changed, there's a kingdom coming, and we maybe are inclined to read that as the people did in the early days, read that as an imminent change. And of course, as we know, the church expected imminent change. But actually, the idea of an early church gives it away. The imminent change did not come. The imminent change did not come. It carried on. So, the coming kingdom was not about to happen through some celestial maneuver within a decade of his death. The coming kingdom was an engagement with the world as it was, not some transformed world as a result of some apocalypse fantasy. And therefore, the kingdom of God was on earth. And therefore, this was a politics of the present and not just a spiritual aspiration for the future. I think that little tap is like 2 minutes. It hasn't yet become rude. Is that right? I'm trying to
You've
read
got
it.
2 minutes more from
And
that.
Then there's a little bit of a thump. In about 2 minutes' time?
In a minute, there'll be another tinkle.
Does this clarificatory point count towards my
you're
2 minutes?
You're eating up your time. Yeah.
I'm eating up my time. I like playing with danger. So I say the kingdom of God was about earth. I say his ideas about equality could only make sense in the context of engagement on earth. Otherwise, it was eccentric. And I say, therefore, that he was committed to civil engagement and therefore was involved in politics. And all I need then to establish is that he would have chosen the Democratic Party over the party of the Republicans. And I think I rest my case. I think what I have just said shows you the contrast between the two. Romney, of course, transforming himself as Bush did. We remember Bush needed to win by pretending to be compassionate. Romney transforms himself. His own man was totally honest about it. When we get into the election, we'll pretend to be centrist. This goes on each time in the American elections. Billionaires pouring money in to buy the election as a result of a fixed Supreme Court ruling that allows it. And up against it, the human rights guy from Chicago. The human rights guy from Chicago, who eschewed the big corporate money, didn't have a father who looked after everything and went for the presidency as a kind of hobby and said to his son, you might have a go at it, as though it was some possession available only to the powerful. Fought his way up. Now, final point before the super tinkle. A tinkle isn't the sort of thing you expect to be super. He might, Jesus, have been out there occupying St. Paul's. He might have been in Wall Street. He might have been engaged in the Putney debates that the Occupy people are doing in a couple of weeks in Putney. But he'd have been voting as well, because he didn't allow what he believed to become an alibi for the continuation of inequality under cover of some kind of spiritual nirvana that was going to come sometime soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So that was Conor Geertie making the spirited case that Jesus would have voted Democrat. To make now the polar opposite case that no, Jesus would have voted Republican. You've welcomed him before, but James Boyes.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight, and I appreciate you all coming out on such an awful evening. I think what we've heard from Conor is very interesting. We've had some good laughs, but unfortunately, we've learnt very little about the Democratic Party that he's suggesting that Jesus Christ would have voted for. I think I've got quite a difficult task here tonight. I imagine that most of you are psychologically, politically predisposed against my position, but what I'd like to try and do is address what I believe are some of the misconceptions that you may be potentially acting under and hopefully not voting under. A few weeks ago, Rosamund Irwin wrote of this evening's debate in the Evening Standard that, quote, as a left-leaning individual, I might be expected to support this motion. After all, Jesus was good on the poor and presumably counted immigrants amongst the neighbours we should all love. In reality, though, I would abstain. A few years ago, Robert Kennedy in 1964 suggested his brother, the late president, believed that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a moral crisis, preserve their neutrality. And I fear that we have a few of those on the panel tonight. So what I suggest to you, ultimately, good people, is that I'm asking you to make a decision between voting for the Democratic option or the Republican option. And that what I think you are going to have to do is try and hopefully listen to myself and think about some of the misconceptions that I believe are perpetuated about the Republican and the Democratic Party. I'm not going to try and quote chapter and verse to you, but perhaps try and talk to you about the history of these two parties and to let you make your own minds up. So we have to make a decision here. Which Christ would we consider? The past tense is what's called for in the question. Christ would have voted for the Democratic Party. This life it makes life a little interesting because, of course, very little is known about Christ, the individual. Certainly he came from a background that espoused traditional family values. I think we can recognise that. His parents, Joseph and Mary, were quite determined that they should be married before he was born, after all. His parents decided to stay in a stable. They didn't claim housing benefit in the effort to do so. Fascinatingly enough, he was courted by that 1% from birth, being visited by wealthy, wise men bearing gifts, the like of which was not open to most of the other 99% of citizens at that time. What was his career, I ask you? He was a carpenter. He was a non-union man, a sole trader, a businessman, if you will, making bookstops for a good knockdown price. His speeches famously advocated personal responsibility and generosity. He was a non-advocate of state action. One can almost hear him saying, ringing throughout the years, "The Roman Empire is not the answer to our problems. The Roman Empire is the problem." Echoing, of course, Ronald Reagan. Of course, we have a problem with this. The Jesus of biblical times could not vote. For one thing, he was not an American citizen. Another, of course, the United States would not be established for another 1,743 years after his untimely death. He could not vote for the Democrats until some 20 years after that, or for the Republican Party until its establishment in 1854. Surely Christ, however, would have defended any and voted for any party which would have defended Israel. And fascinatingly enough, although I'm sure it is going to be mentioned later on that American Jews have a tendency to vote for the Democratic Party, the 100,000 Israelis who do get a vote in the United States do so overwhelmingly for the Republican Party. I open my remarks today by suggesting that I believe we are focusing upon a misinterpretation of fact. And I think most of that is based upon that of the Republican Party. The Republican Party is not that of George W. Bush any more than we base our understanding of what Christ was like upon the appearance of Robert Powell in the Jesus of Nazareth miniseries that some of you may have remembered from the 1970s. What do I mean by the Republican Party being misunderstood? I suggest to you that surely Christ would support environmentalism and the national parks environment in the United States, created by Republican President Teddy Roosevelt. Surely Jesus Christ would believe in freedom and equality, and the freedom of the slaves, which was allowed by President Abraham Lincoln, a Republican. Surely Christ would believe in Environmental Protection Agency, protected by and designed by and created by that most wonderful of Republican presidents, Richard Nixon. Surely Jesus Christ would be glad the Cold War is over, a Cold War which was ended by Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. Surely Jesus Christ would believe in nuclear disarmament, and we need to acknowledge the key role played in that by Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. Surely Christ taught us to believe in forgiveness, and there can be few greater examples in American political life than the pardon of Richard Nixon by Gerald Ford. No sign of a quid pro quo there, I assure you. These are all acts of a Republican administration. And if you believe, of course, that Christ was a pacifist, a peace-loving individual who sought to avoid war, let us not forget that the Republicans advocated avoiding the First and Second World Wars. I'd like to talk a little bit about race, if you wouldn't mind, tonight, because I think race is a very interesting point here. Surely Christ taught us, above all, to love our neighbour. No mention of colour there. The Republican Party was formed in 1854 for the specific purpose of ending slavery in the United States. A decade later, the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, issued the Emancipation Proclamation doing just that. In 1865, the 13th Amendment, formally and legally freeing the slaves, was passed with every Republican in the House and the Senate voting in favor, but only 19 Democrats supporting it. It was Republicans against Democratic opposition that passed the 14th Amendment, establishing citizenship for former slaves, and the 15th Amendment granting African Americans the right to vote. It was Republicans who first passed the Civil Rights Acts of 1866 and 1875, which were later repealed by the Democrats with the passage of the Repeal Act in 1894. Over a century later, it was Republicans that passed through the Civil Rights Act, with 80% of Republicans voting in the 1964 Act, compared to only 64% of Democrats. It was Republicans who named the first African-American to the Supreme Court, and the first male and female African-Americans to be Secretary of State in the form of Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. Finally, ladies, in a year in which we have heard much about the supposed Republican war on women, it was the Republican Party that voted overwhelmingly in numbers to endorse women's suffrage in 1919, whilst Democrats sought to actively filibuster the bill by talking it to death. If any of that has given you any cause for thought, and I hope it has, let us consider the history of the Democratic Party in areas of race and warfare, and ask yourself, does any of this sound like a party that Jesus Christ would endorse with his vote? On race, during an 1872 congressional investigation, the Democrats admitted to forming the Ku Klux Klan as a way to stop the growth of the Republican Party. The PBS show, the equivalent of the BBC, the American Experience show, noted, quote, "In outright defiance of the Republican-led federal government, Southern Democrats formed organizations to violently intimidate African Americans and Republicans who tried to win political power. The most prominent of this was the Ku Klux Klan." The Jim Crow laws in the South passed by the Democrats, the fugitive slave laws which returned runaway slaves to their owners, Democrats. The 1856 Supreme Court decision, the Dred Scott case, legally defining African Americans as the property of their masters, a 7-2 decision written by the Chief Justice, Roger Taney, a Democrat, with every concurring vote cast by Democrat judges. Passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, repealing the slave-limiting Missouri Compromise, passed by Democrats. Harry Truman, future President of the United States, member of the Kansas City Ku Klux Klan, Democrat. Lest any of you think this is just about race, Truman also acceded to his wife's wishes that no Jew ever be allowed in the family home. The 1960s Civil Rights Act, which most people, I think, would give to the Democrats. Let me tell you, the biggest hurdle faced by Presidents Kennedy and Johnson during the passage of that legislation was not Republicans, but Southern racist Democrats. The most vocal opponents of the Civil Rights Act were all Southern Democrats, including Albert Gore Sr., father of the future Vice President, former Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd, the Grand Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan, who sought to filibuster passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act by speaking for 14 hours straight in the Senate. This was the same Robert Byrd who said, quote, "I would rather die 1,000 times and see Old Glory, the American flag, trampled in the dirt, never to rise again, than see this beloved land of ours degraded by race mongrels, a throwback to the blackest specimen of the wilds." Bill Clinton defended this, saying, quote, "They mentioned that Robert Byrd once had a fleeting association with the Klan. What does this mean? I'll tell you what it means. He was a country boy from the hollows of West Virginia and trying to get elected." Contrast this with Mitt Romney, who we just heard about. His father, Governor George Romney, led a procession of 10,000 marchers in Detroit in support of Martin Luther King after the attacks on Selma. It was a Democrat Alabama governor, George Wallace. Some of you may have seen him in Forrest Gump, who in his inaugural address said, "Segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever." Blessed are the peacemakers. Let's talk about war. The Democratic Party brought America into World War I, II, Korea and Vietnam. It is still the only political party to have unleashed nuclear weapons in anger, killing 70,000 immediately in Hiroshima, another 130,000 later dying. So much of what we believe just isn't the case. As Mark Twain said, it ain't what you know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't the case. This, I believe, is the true history of the Democratic Party that you will not read about in The Guardian. No offence, Jonathan. I put it to you that the Republican Party has been inaccurately characterised and that the aspects of the past and vitally the history of the Democratic Party ensure that upon reflection, the Son of God would have had but one option: to vote for the party that freed the slaves, embraced female suffrage, protected the environment, ended the Cold War. He would have voted Republican. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to James Boyes for that very spirited case that Jesus would have voted Republican. I mentioned in our opening that it was fashionable often for Southern and other Christian conservatives in America to wear the button WWJD, what would Jesus do? I hadn't realised that Jesus himself wore a button saying, what would Reagan do? But I learned that tonight. I must give a warning to our next two speakers that I will be properly offended if there isn't an attack on The Guardian in their speech. We've had now two and counting. To make the case that Jesus would have been a swing voter from Conservative Home, Tim Montgomery.
Well, thank you very much for having me here today, and thank you to Intelligence Squared for putting on this well-timed debate. We do know, of course, with the hurricane raging across America Today that Jesus has already given his verdict on the on this motion. He is clearly a swing voter, unhappy at both of the candidates, and he would be supporting me in this motion. When Jesus spent his short time on earth, particularly his earthly ministry, he didn't, of course, spend a lot of time talking about politics. And it is, of course, as Connor said at the beginning, it is not how we would vote as individuals. The motion before us is about how Jesus would vote. So I scoured the Bible in preparation for tonight's debate, looking for clues as to Jesus's party politics. What did he think of the problem of potholes on the road to Bethlehem? I could find no evidence that he was concerned about those issues, and therefore he's not a Liberal Democrat. What was his view on the high tax on bread, fishes, and milk and honey? Again, silence suggests he's not as conservative as I would have liked. He did not have a plan to turn the donkey dung that litters the road to Nazareth into some form of fuel to heat homes, so he wasn't a green. And of course, as we've already been reminded by Jonathan at the beginning, he chose 12 men as his disciples, so he was hardly going to be endearing himself to Harriet Harman or David Cameron's A-list. What is clear is that if you look at the Bible, it isn't easy or even possible to find clear policies from Jesus. It is therefore very difficult to know what he would think precisely of the Democrat or the Republican policy platform at this election or in any of the historical sweep of elections that we've heard about from James and Connor. But he was, of course, political. There's a difference between having policy positions and not being political. He consorted with people that the establishment avoided, the poor, prostitutes. He taught forgiveness and non-violence rather than revolution. He urged charity, solidarity with the poor, but also full use of talents. He was no leveller. I was tempted by the position that I think Giles is about to advance to us, therefore, that Jesus would somehow hold back from taking any position. But it's not something I think I can recommend. For me, it is vital that Christians, followers of Jesus, are involved in politics. I think to be involved in politics is an expression of following his command to love your neighbour. Without Christian involvement, politics is poorer. It may be an old chestnut what Edmund Burke said, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. But just because it's a chestnut doesn't mean it's not true. My political heroes are Christians, Wilberforce, Shaftesbury. And I can't believe that Jesus wouldn't have got behind people like them being involved in politics. Wilberforce, who fought against the slave trade, Shaftesbury, who fought for the urban poor. The question is there a Wilberforce or a Shaftesbury in the race that's taking place in the US elections at the moment, or anything even like close to them? And the answer, unfortunately, I think at the moment is no, and that's why I think Jesus would be a floating voter in this election. But he would try and still find someone who he could support. The problem is both parties have their strengths and weaknesses. We've had a lovely black and white picture from our first two speakers. For me, the strength of the Democrats are their positions on healthcare, ensuring that everybody can be treated regardless of how much they've got in the bank, and a general passion for the poor that Connor began with. But they also are a party of vested interests that opposes black kids having choice for schools in Washington, D.C., because the unions that fund and bankroll Barack Obama stop that choice. And in talk about extremism, they are a party that supports abortion, not just early in pregnancy, but right up until birth. The Republicans have their strengths. They support the family and marriage. They want to protect the unborn. They're worried about debt. But they're also too close to big business and money. They're too belligerent in some of the foreign wars that we've seen recently. James was fantastic in talking about the historical position of the Republicans in militarism, but it's not a position that many people, I think, will recognise from recent times. My guess is the role that Jesus would play in this election would be to ask some very tough questions. I can imagine him not voting enthusiastically for either of these candidates, but asking the kind of questions that anyone who reads the Bible is very familiar with. I think he would go on to Fox News, if they would have him, and say, "Why, Mr. Romney, are you more interested in the issue of gay marriage than poverty in Africa? Why is your party more obsessed with that?" I think he would go on to Jon Stewart's Daily Show and perhaps ask some questions of the Democrats. What happened, Mr. Obama, to all that hope and change? Why now are 85% of the adverts that you are placing on television negative? Why are you building up debts that children will have to repay for many years to come? He would say in the debate, why are all of you spending £2 billion in this, $2 billion in this election? Money that could be used in so many better ways. Finally, I don't think Jesus, of course, would just be political. He would be a pastor. I think he would actually respect them, both of the men in this contest. I think he wouldn't recognise perhaps a Shaftesbury or a Wilberforce in them, but I think he would see two good family men who love their families, love their children. Mitt Romney is a huge philanthropist. Barack Obama began his time in Chicago looking after some of the most vulnerable people in society. And I think he would put the emphasis, as I think he did in his time when he was a minister on earth, on wanting to be a friend to the people in politics. He would focus on their inner reform, because better people are better parents, better business people, and better politicians. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to Tim. Tim made the case that Jesus would have been a swing voter, conjuring up the prospect of Jesus as a guest on Fox News, I'm sure identified as an unmarried community organiser, where he would be unusual for their usual run of guests. And next is our final speaker, making the case that Jesus wouldn't have voted for either main party, the none-of-the-above option, Giles Fraser.
I love the idea of Jesus being on Fox News. I love the idea of him standing there and saying, you know, I come to bring good news to the poor, freedom to the captive, sight to the blind. I love the idea of bringing down the mighty from their thrones and lifting up the lowly. If he said that on Fox News, he would have been accused of being a communist and ran out of town. Look, he's not going to be able to get into the US in the first place. He's an undocumented alien with no visible means of support. And he's from the Middle East. He's travelling on a plane with 12 other people from the Middle East. He is not going to get into the country. But if you grant that Mr. Romney thinks that Jesus managed to get into the country in 1820, then I'm going to grant the premise. I'm going to really piss you off. Would you all stand up?
No, they won't like that.
I want everybody that side of the room to sit on that side of the room and that side of the room on that side of the room, and you have 1 minute, 30 seconds to do it. Go.
He's eating into his time.
Go. And I'm serious too. Absolutely serious.
Do we have to do it?
We don't have to do it.
Some are moving, some are not moving. I'm not going to move. I can see the people with their arms folded. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. What's this for? It's a gimmick. I'm not doing this. When you do it in churches, vicars never move. The panel's not moving.
Controversy.
30 seconds. Now, that's fine to do here in Chelsea Town Hall, easy to do. There'll be some people who cheesed off, cheap trick. I've done that in St Paul's Cathedral. I've got to say, that really pissed people off there. The choir were annoyed. The congregation were annoyed. The vicars who had their particular seats were annoyed. Nobody liked me for doing it. And the sermon that comes after that goes something like this. Is that Jesus comes into the world, and he comes into the world, and he asks you to transform your whole life, transform everything about who you are. And we're irritated just moving seats. We're irritated just moving seats. And he asks you to do something so radical, so transformative, that you will be thoroughly, completely and utterly pissed off with him for doing it. And the reason I'm telling you this is that Jesus is not and never will be in the popularity business. There's some cracking books about this. Look at the Brothers Karamazov is obviously the great version. Jesus comes back into Seville and the church, he comes back to find the church. And what does the church do to Jesus when he comes back and starts preaching his message in the square? It locks him up. It's too dangerous. It's too difficult. The message he comes is not nice or practical or even moral. Nikos Kazantzakis, who wrote Zorba the Greek, he wrote a fantastic book called Christ Re-Crucified. It's a brilliant book. And the premise of the book is that you have one of those great passion plays, and one of these characters takes on the role of Jesus. And he's a method actor. So he sort of gets into the part and becomes like Jesus. And what happens when they do the final scene is the actor, being a method actor, has annoyed them, pissed them off so much that they actually crucify him. Jesus won no popularity contests. Right at the end, at the moment of, as it were, triumph, is failure. And Jesus continually plays with the idea that failure and success are very closely related to each other. The first will be last, and the last first. Politicians who stand up there and go, I have all this morally sewn up. This is the right way. This is the best way. Who present themselves really terribly well. Jesus could not, would not, vote for those people. They are sucking in an insipid, diminished, moralized version of Christianity. Of course, the Christianity that you get in the States is, by and large, the religion of the flag. I've preached many times in the United States, and I honestly think that they'd really, really mind if you took the stars and stripes out of the sanctuary a lot more than if you took the cross out of the sanctuary. That's what they really mind. And Jesus would have gone in there and he would have been lynched by American voters. And that would have been another story of the Gospels, as he was lynched by the Romans. Now, the question here is how you can conscript this person into a political realm that wants to just keep things as they are.
Christianity is not fundamentally about morality. When John Bunyan wrote Pilgrim's Progress, the very first temptation that Pilgrim meets on the journey is to settle in a little village called Morality. It's next to the language, it's next to the village called, I think, Civility or something like that. But that's the idea that we all have to be a bit more moral, just a bit nicer. That's not the message that Jesus comes to bring. He actually talks, and this is, yes, time to talk like the preacher. He talks about salvation. And salvation isn't about being a bit more moral. It starts by going, I am pathetic. I cannot do it. I have failed. I'm rubbish. And I need help. It's almost like in Alcoholics Anonymous, when you go, I can't help myself. I need help from outside of myself. Now, this sounds uncomfortably like a pulpit saying that one needs to be saved. And I'm doing that deliberately to show you that language of salvation, is not easily purloined by those who want to talk movingly about the virtues of the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. It's not easily purloined because it's so much more personal and transformative. Of course Jesus would have said to the Democratic Party, to Mr. Obama, Guantanamo Bay, did you really close that down? Of course he would have spoken to the Republican Party about the 1% and the 99%. He would have challenged all those views. And yes, he would have also challenged those of us who sit on our hands and do nothing. But the heart of all of this message is a message too radical and too transformative, too irritating. America is a country of winners. It likes to be a country of winners. Christ says, the first will be last and the last first. And if you want to win, you first must learn how to lose. That's not a message that you could possibly find on any electoral banner in the United States of America. Unless those parties know how to lose, in Christian terms, they could never know how to win. Jesus would have been a part of none of it had he ever got into the country in the first place and not been arrested.
Thank you. Giles says that message that the first will be last and the last will be first, and before you can win, you have to first know how to lose, has never been or could never be part of a political campaign message. I'm tempted to say Jimmy Carter tried his best to make that work, but it didn't really work out for him. So I have for you the results of the preliminary vote as you came in. So this is where you stood before you'd been swayed by the superb flights of rhetoric and sheer force of intellectual argument. And Ciceronian logic that has been laid before you. Here's where you stood then. In the verbal pre-vote, those who said Jesus would vote Democrat numbered 175. Those who said Jesus would vote Republican numbered 35.
Thank you very much.
So you have
more than I expected.
I think the only way is up for you. I mean, I think that was a very steep mountain to climb, so to speak. And then the swing voters. All right, the swing voters. Those who think Jesus would have been a swing voter, undecided. And Tim, maybe later you'll tell us where Jesus in the end would have come down on November the 6th. They numbered 50. So more than voted for Jesus as a Republican. And finally, with a large figure, for those who believe Jesus wouldn't have voted for either main party, 131 votes. So the two positions to beat, really, tonight are those who think Jesus would have been a Democrat and those who think Jesus would have backed neither party. And so we'll see how the debate moves, or has already moved, perhaps, now that you've heard those speeches. So, the time has come to throw open the floor to you to make this a conversation rather than just a sermon, a series of sermons from our pulpit here. So we have various people with microphones dotted around. I'm going to be as inclusive as I possibly can and try and get as many questions in as I can. So why don't we see some hands up? Questions either for the whole panel or for individuals there. All right, so we have somebody here. That's good. And if you bring the microphone to the man with the Old Testament beard, I would say, at the back. We're going to start over here, though. We're going to start here and then come to you seconds. Yeah, you go first.
Who would Jesus have marched with, Billy Graham or Martin Luther King?
Thank you. So the question was, who would Jesus have marched with, Billy Graham or Martin Luther King? I'm going to take a group of questions just so we get them all in. Yeah.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I think the person of our times right now is Bradley Manning. And I'm wondering, and I want to know the view on each person here, if they know who Bradley Manning is and why he's significant. And I think support for him is very important. That's my question. Actually, I had something else to say, but I'll give the floor to other people.
All right, not strictly on our topic, but we can, I'm sure, have reactions that can fit with our topic. Let's go to somebody up there on the balcony in what I would call the gods, but don't want to attempt any groaning laughter. There we go. Yes. I'm going to keep doing that now. I'm on a roll. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, no, it's you. It's still being passed along.
While I'm swayed by our last two speakers, I'm wondering whether Christ would not have been a pragmatist, in other words, faced with one or the other. This isn't parliamentary. There aren't a number of parties. It's either this or that. And faced with that reality, would he not have voted Democrat? If the last two speakers would address that issue.
Okay, let's first of all just why don't we just pick straight up with that? The idea that in the end, if you have to make a decision, Charles Fraser, why don't you address first of all this question of wouldn't Jesus in the end have thought that it is some kind of civic responsibility to take part in society, he cared about society, and just sitting out and sitting on his hands wouldn't have suited him, he would have in the end voted for someone. And then I'm going to put to Tim who that would have been.
I mean, he's definitely not pragmatic. He's not a pragmatist. I mean, he's an extremist of the most extraordinary kind in a way that makes us feel uncomfortable. For example, we've talked about the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, so one of the things that Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount is like, you know, you've heard it said before that if you commit adultery, that's a very bad thing. Okay, I'm going to say to you, if you even look at a woman like that, you've committed adultery. There's nothing practical about the idea that adultery is, I've committed adultery at least 2,000 times today on the Jesus definition of what adultery is. Jesus is not he pushes that moral thing to breaking point where you realize that you failed. This is not a pragmatic position about ethics. He's not John Stuart Mill laying out something terribly sensible. So no, in terms of the election, in terms of, you know, sort of laying down sensible moral policies, it's just that's the sort of things of that's a sort of progressive view of how you might get better. He thinks that things have to be worse before they can get anywhere near better.
So therefore he might have voted for...
Well, he might have voted for the Republican Party in the same way. My first time I voted for Mrs. Thatcher when I was a member of the Socialist Worker Party. And the reason I voted for Mrs. Thatcher was because that was obviously going to make things so much worse that it would bring about the revolution, and then the revolution would clearly, you know,
This is so-called revolutionary defeatism.
I don't think that anymore.
What amazes me is how many people in this meeting here in Chelsea are nodding as if they too did this in their youth.
We've all been members of the Socialist Worker Party.
I have a feeling there was
Chelsea branch.
The Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea division. So to you, Tim Montgomery, you know, you made a very good case for a swing voter who would see something to be commended in both parties and something to criticise in both parties. But in the end, a swing voter does, by the usual definition, make a decision, even if they're a late decider. Where would Jesus have eventually voted in this election?
I'm afraid I'm going to still sit on the fence. And it's slightly the answer to the gentleman's question about
who would Jesus march with? He would march with both of them, I think. For me, Catholic social teaching, in its emphasis on being pro-life, we associate the Catholic Church with its position on abortion, because that's the one that's most controversial. But the true pro-life position is to believe in racial equality, is to believe in dignity for the elderly, is certainly to protect the unborn, in my view. It's to ensure that disabled people have equal rights. And I think Jesus would be on the side of everybody who was fighting for equality for every human being under the law and with in full respect. And the problem, I think, in American politics at the moment, the American system is designed to stop bad things happening. You've got the tension between Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court. It's designed to ensure you can't have revolution or big change. The problem is, when you have a massive problem like America has at the moment with huge dysfunctionality in government, huge debt, it means that same apparatus that supposedly stops bad things happening quickly, or also stops good things happening quickly. And we have a Democrat Party on one side that seems to think you can solve every problem by taxing the 1%. It just doesn't add up in any sense. And then you have the Republicans who just don't face up to the fact that the middle classes at the moment don't pay enough tax. So on all sorts of levels, I'm afraid I'm still sitting on the fence.
All right. And to you, James Boyes, the question up there said, OK, they can see it's a nuanced and a difficult decision that Jesus hypothetically would have to make. But in the end, he said, he would have to be a Democrat, partly because of some of the positions we've heard set out tonight on poverty, on the 1%, etc.
Well, I have to disagree. I don't think the question made a case about why he should be a Democrat, and I don't think I've heard anything from the panellists either who made me think about a true examination of American politics either. I have to come back to your point at the front here, sir. You asked who Christ would march with. Would he march with King or Graham? Tim raises a good point, which is that he would be on the side of anybody who was fighting injustice and intolerance. I think the question is phrased as though to suggest that, well, King will be a Democrat and Graham will be a Republican. And certainly, Billy Graham has certainly prayed with a number of Republican candidates and has just come out and endorsed Romney. However, it is vital to remember that if you're suggesting somehow that King was a Democrat and that the Republicans were opposed to him, I bring you back to my point I was trying to make, which was during the Civil Rights Act passage of the 1960s, President Kennedy and President Johnson, who both personally embraced Martin Luther King, their biggest challenge was not with the Republican Party. It was with the Southern Democratic racists who time and time again, you shake your head, but this was certainly true. I'm talking about you asked me specifically about King, and I'm addressing that. The problem with King was the fact that the Republicans were endorsing that, and it was the Democrats within Kennedy and Johnson's own party who were causing all the problems in terms of getting that through.
What about the argument that says you've made a really good case that Jesus would certainly have been, if confronted with this choice 50 years ago or 100 years ago, a Republican rather than a Democrat, but in today's politics, how do you make the case that on today's choice he would be with the Republicans rather than the Democrats?
Well, of course, the question was, would have voted Republican? I was trying to get across this idea that you need to look at the whole past. Well, you laugh.
So do you think he wouldn't vote Republican now?
I certainly think that if you look at what Mitt Romney does as an individual, I think he's an individual who gives an awful lot of money and time to charity. And I think one of the big problems, I would ask you to vote upon the basis of fact and not upon the idea of misinterpretation and misrepresentation. And I look forward to making that case to you in my closing arguments.
Okay, I've got more I could follow up with, but I won't. But Conor Gitte, I'm looking to you to see if you can see some way of making Bradley Manning fit into your answer on how Jesus would vote in the election.
Yeah,
and your human rights background makes me think you're the man to do it.
I can. I'm not going to do it immediately. All of those Democrats are now Republican. That's what's happened. I can't let it go. Reagan turned the Southern Democrats Republican. Roosevelt held that coalition together by accepting them. So did Truman. Everything we heard from James is spot on. What's happened to them? They've migrated to the Republican Party. It's extraordinary to raise an objection based on that history when they are now leading that party into the Tea Party perdition. On Bradley Manning, he's the good thief. He's been crucified for an heroic act of justice. He's the man, so far as I understand it, the chap is the back who was responsible for making generally known the extent to which there was complicity and terrible behaviour in the United States. And he's been jailed. Am I thinking about the right guy? Are you going to nod?
Yeah,
he's in jail?
Well,
Yeah.
And I'll explain for everyone else. Bradley Manning is widely thought to be the source for the WikiLeaks documents that went around the world, State Department cables, war logs in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I mean, he is the true victim of the WikiLeaks scandal. Meanwhile, Julian Assange has been visited by the sort of Lady Gaga in the Ecuadorian embassy, which was hilarious because, of course, he had no escape from Lady Gaga. He had no escape. Now, there might be one thing worse than Sweden with its pernicious pro-American covert torturing commitment to render him back to the United States. There might be one thing worse than the horrors of a Swedish jail, and that probably is 5 hours with Lady Gaga. Apparently she stayed for 5 hours. Billy Graham is, so far as I know, is a good man. So far as I know. I have to say, a lot of charlatans and crooks have followed in his wake, exploiting the naivety of undereducated people for personal gain by presenting them with a false form of religion. But Billy Graham is a good man. However, Jesus Christ would have walked with Martin Luther King. And if you take one thing out of this, forgetting about the vote, read Letter from Birmingham Jail. From Martin Luther King to the pastors who did not defend him because of their distaste for his search for justice. It will make the hair on your back stand now, on the back of your neck stand now. So extraordinary is it. There is no question but that he would have been marching and been beaten in the support he would have shown for that heroic figure.
Thank you. Let's take some more contributions. There's more hands going up. We haven't yet visited this side. So if you can bring the microphone to these two people who are near each other, perhaps we'll start with the first hand that I can say yes, here. So we'll begin with you, and then we're going to go to the chap in the blue sweater. Yeah.
Wouldn't the panel all agree that it's inconceivable that Jesus would have participated in any way in this election, and that what he in fact would have been doing was exposing the hypocrisy of the US democratic system as it currently stands?
So I'll put you down as a don't know, shall I? I think you're with Giles on this, but let's we'll pass the microphone to the chap in the blue. Now, I'm very keen that we make up for our deficit on the panel here by having some women speakers, so I'm going to look for hands that are going up, and I think there may be one or two here. So, good, yeah.
Do you think, rather than making the inevitable compromises of picking one side or the other, Jesus might have got very involved and set up his own party or his own movement?
Very interesting. That's a very interesting one. I want to hear all of you on that. Jesus setting up his own party. And let's go to the questioner here. Yeah.
Of course,
a bit closer, there we are.
Thank you. Jesus, of course, distinctly evaded getting involved in politics in his own time. And in fact, that I think is one of the reasons why Judas Iscariot turned against him and other people, because they had hoped that he would actually fight against the Romans, and he didn't choose to do that. And indeed, he said that people should pay their tax and actually sort of, you know, go along with the status quo as it was. But the point, and I, of course, that wasn't in an era of democracy, which would change the whole facet of the debate. But the point I wanted to ask James Boyce was, he has a rather touching sort of belief in philanthropy. And of course, Jesus says that you shouldn't let your right hand know what the left is giving, or something like that. And I think there's something rather morally abhorrent about philanthropy, which is used as a way of evading taxes and indeed of, you know, self-glorification. You know, it's so much nicer to give your money to something which will then have your name emblazoned on it and you'll be invited to all the best parties.
Thank you. Is there one more I'll get in this round, particularly looking for a woman questioner, if there is one? Is there one at the back? There we are. I think I can see a hand right at the back. We'll just squeak. Yeah, right at the back. The last hand at the back there. Okay, well, I was going to get you. But...
Don't you think Jesus would have been happier with a more communist, shall we say, socialist system?
Thank you. Okay, well, I did see the hand at the back there, and you're going to be the next one in our next round. But I just want to get through all of these. So we have that Jesus would have been a socialist, and at this point about philanthropy. Let's just go to Tim Montgomery first. Would Jesus have set up his own party? You expressed the view of the swing voter, dissatisfied with the choice on offer. Would Jesus' response to be, okay, you know, I mean, you could say he decided to set up his own religion. Wouldn't he have set up his own party? I know, historically debatable, I know. Yeah.
Well, look, the Jesus Party would have Giles and myself in it. You know, that's the trouble with the Jesus Party. The church don't agree on a lot of political questions. The last time Giles and I were together, was not quite together, but it was over the airways, disagreeing on the Today programme. It's always often proposed this idea of a Christian political party, but Christians, although they could be motivated to in the same way, and I hope probably both of us have similar ends, the means is where the disagreement is. And that's the crux of the problem of having a Christian political party or Jesus having a political party. He doesn't specify how to do things. And the thought of some of the people I go to church with having any position of influence or power in this country frightens me a great deal. We elect largely politicians as technicians, hopefully well-motivated and good people, but it's why I struggle so much with Jesus having a vote in this election, because there just isn't in the Bible the authority to say this is the particular best way of doing things. And it's why the questions about is Jesus a communist or a socialist, I think where Connor started with this presumption that if you are in favour of the poor, you are a Democrat or you are of the left or you're a socialist or a communist. I actually think that the best way of looking after the poor is the dynamic capitalist economy that creates jobs, that has strong families where people are parented properly, where we have schools that teach people adequate skills. The most important people aren't the state and the taxman, but they are the parent, the teacher, and the job creator. Now, I happen to believe that that is a thoroughly moral view of how you run a society, but it's not, I don't think, necessarily what Giles would prioritise. It's not necessarily what a whole range of Christians would prioritise.
Giles.
I mean, one of the things that really needs to be said in this is whether Jesus would have been all that keen on democracy at all. I mean, I think, you know, the idea that he spoke about a kingdom of heaven, which is not a democracy, and you don't actually get the feeling that when he was having a conversation with his friends, there was a show of hands at the end about what the way forward was going to be. That's really not the way he operated. And why I do all that stuff about he would have annoyed you is that in terms of getting your vote, there's all sorts of things that people say about Christianity to sort of butter you up that you'd like to hear. I mean, I think we've had it from the right-wing members of our panel, for instance, here, when they talk about the family and Jesus very keen on the family. Have they actually read the New Testament when they talk about Jesus being terribly keen on the family? Not a bit of it. I mean, he's terribly rude to his mum. He says that traditional blood ties don't matter, and it's about belief. It's about they're the real family, not the sort of brothers and sisters, who the hell are they? Jesus does not believe in family values as the right portray them, but actually that's a good Christian vote winner. Basically, Jesus is much more disturbing than Christianity.
I want to get other people. Come back to I'm very interested in this idea of Jesus not being a Democrat with a small d, not believing in democracy. I want to hear more on that. But before we do, I want to bring in Conor Gearty. Questioner asking whether actually these are the wrong labels, and that if you believe Jesus was a political thinker, and let's remember, by the way, that when George W. Bush was asked to name his favourite political philosopher, his answer was Jesus. And anyone who says that's the only one he'd heard of, wash your mouth out. Wash your mouth out right away. But the question to you, Connor, was, are these the wrong labels? Even your one that you're championing tonight about Democrat, really, if anything, he'd have been a socialist or a communist, our questioner said.
Yeah, I know. And just getting to that, but the first guy, I think I have no problem. He would have participated. He would have done other things. I think he would have voted, but he would have been activist as well. On that one, that's a really key one for us to reflect on. You see, I think he sort of did set up his own party. He didn't have a liberal approach, church and state separation. He created with St. Peter an opportunity for a church. And in its very early days, it was communist. It was one of its amazing appeals to the Romans, was the extent to which it forwent all sorts of privilege and was very egalitarian, very good in the first century with women. And a memory, an echo of that, was evident in the 1960s, 1970s, with something called liberation theology, which was about systemic injustice being part of what God, Jesus, was trying to root out. The problem has been this contradiction between survival and justice, and the church has put survival before justice. So it's lasted, but at a price of conceding too much to the wing of the party, the Christian party, whatever form it takes, which puts wealth and power before justice and truth. Maybe that's a necessary tension, but I'd say he did set out to create a party, and it was essentially a socialist party and a communist party before Marx, but in order to survive, it had to concede to power, and that's one of the contradictions with which we live.
But given that, why then, if his heart was in socialism or communism, why would it mean you'd vote Democrat in this?
Oh, because he's a pragmatist in the sense that he would vote. He would not vote. He would have very strong views about the power of money in the American elections, but he would not vote. That's where Giles, seeking to intervene, is wrong, I think. Okay. Giles.
I have to go. I want to get James in as quick as I can.
I'm just going to say one cheap shot, which is, because my friend Connor is a Roman Catholic, we haven't said that, and one of the things, if it is the case that Jesus set up his own party, and presumably you mean by that the Roman Catholic Church...
Well, I was trying to be slightly discreet about this,
I would
Giles.
Say that, as a Protestant, I protest against that party, so it's not a united front, it has to be said.
OK, thank you. Now, let's bring in James Boyes. The questioner asked about the philanthropy of Mitt Romney, and I think it's not denied that he has extraordinary record of philanthropy and of giving, and not always actually for egotistical reasons. A lot of it was anonymous, so we understand. But nevertheless, that is morally abhorrent, said the questioner, if you're doing it to avoid taxes. And you cannot get away from it, can you, James Boyes, that Mitt Romney pays a tax rate of 14% in the common coinage, you know, a big CEO paying less than his cleaner pays proportionally in tax, 14%. How do you live with that?
I don't. I think it's abhorrent. I think 14% for Mitt Romney to be paying income tax. Anybody here want to pay 14% income tax? Yeah, me too, quite frankly. The problem you've got ultimately is do you take a jaundiced view of philanthropy and say because people get tax breaks for doing it, therefore it is morally reprehensible? And I don't know if that's quite the point you're making. If it isn't, then do forgive me. But I think that even if people do get a tax break out of giving and being involved in philanthropy, we do need to look at the other side of this, which is that an awful lot of good does come from it. An awful lot of good money does go to good causes. And it's important to recognise, and I think Jonathan would perhaps back me up on this, is that the Romneys haven't made a big song and a dance out about this themselves. What has happened is that people have come to their support to say, look, you've got the wrong idea about this guy. One of the points I was trying to make in my talk is this idea of people voting and making decisions based upon misinformation. And one of the things that the Democratic Party has admitted it's done, Bill Clinton was very instrumental in this, was saying, look, if you want to beat Mitt Romney, you've got to portray him as the next George W. Bush, as an extremist. I don't know how much you know about Mitt Romney's political background, but this guy was governor of Massachusetts. He was Republican governor of Massachusetts. You do not get to be governor of Massachusetts as a Republican by being a hardline Republican. You have to be a moderate to do that, same as Schwarzenegger in California. So this idea that Romney is somehow some sort of rabid right-winger who wants to take America back into war like another George W. Bush is fundamentally flawed, and it's the myth that's been perpetuated by the Democratic Party because of a policy that Bill Clinton suggested that Mitt Romney adopt. Sorry, Obama adopt.
Obama adopt. Thank you. We've got about 5 minutes to get a new round of questions in. The lady at the back has waited very patiently. She was, in fact, his classic case where the last will be first, because she was last before and now is going to be first. Yes.
Thank you to James Boyes. You made a great point that the Jesus would have voted Republican in the past, but in the last 30 years, would you still argue the case? I mean, Iraq, Grenada... Yeah. I mean, you guys were the peacemakers. You invaded Grenada. Come on. So just, that's my question to you.
I appreciate your question.
Thank you. That's great. Let's see if we can get two or three more. Lady here, and then we'll go to the chat there. And is there anybody up there who I've missed? Not yet. Okay, lady here. And keep your hand up there so that the lady here with the microphone can find you. There we are. Yeah.
It seems to me that Jesus was actually not interested in politics at all. There are two crucial things. One is render unto Caesar. So he's actually saying, forget about politics.
Render unto Caesar.
Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. That's one thing. And the other thing is that classic and wonderful example of whether it's Mary Magdalene or whoever, who spends an extraordinary amount of money, thousands in our terms, on the ointment that she washes his feet with. And he says, in response to Judas's sensible question, which is, why not spend this on the poor you have with you always, me you've only got for a little time, which seems to me an extraordinary answer for a man who you all consider to be a sort of political revolutionary to some extent.
Mm. Wait on, because we want to get one more question in, but it's a yes, gentleman here.
As this might be an assumption, but as perhaps the sole atheist in the audience, could I invite the panel respectfully to consider that this debate might have been a waste of time? Speculating about the political sensibilities of their imaginary friend. But more seriously, I do have a serious point. Is it not dangerous to do God at election time? Doesn't it have the capacity to alienate people? Because it inevitably invites the question, which God and whose God?
Thank you. That's a really interesting question. I think even plenty of atheists don't believe Jesus was an imaginary friend, believe he was a historical character. But we appreciate the question, which makes us reframe it. Let's see if I can get one more in before we take it back to the panel here. Somebody up there. Yeah, this is going to be the last one, I'm afraid. Lots of hands waving. I can't quite see, but I'm sure you're going to pass the microphone to the right person.
Yes, I don't know whether we know much about Canada, whether the Prime Minister there is a believer, he loves Israel, and everything about the economy and childcare and health and education is doing much better. You know, the economy, the GDP, and I think you've had the Toronto blessing in Canada, and that, you know, he would be behind the people who would be praying for the very best for the country. And I think there we have, a country that has a very good president, and a prime minister, and he's doing well.
Well, Tim Montgomery, I would be very interested in your reaction to that endorsement of Cameron coming from the upper tier there. But let's go with these couple of questions that we've got. First one to... why don't we put this to you, Conor Gearty, first of all, that isn't it rather dangerous to bring God into politics? Our atheist questioner asked that, isn't this... there's actually good logic in that old Alistair Campbell statement of saying we don't do God, that actually we should keep religion and politics quite separate.
Well, if I was running for office in this country, I'd be a bit nervous. I agree with you. I think Alistair Campbell may have been politically astute, but we're not. We're actually reflecting a set of feelings which are profoundly felt by large numbers of people, and we're trying to change opinion. And one of the things we're trying to do is get people to see that if you believe in your religion, you actually want to change the world, and you are restless in your pursuit of that, and that it's about dialogue and democracy, not about imposing your will through authority. So I think that maybe it's a problem for political leaders who seek votes. Maybe it's a problem for secularists who are very anxious about what God brings to the table and unsettled by it. But it certainly isn't a problem for me. Nor is the ointment, by the way. This guy's a little bit big-headed. He's a bit of a show. He got rid of the cousin. It's understandable.
Just on the ointment point, which I have to say was new to me, that's a fascinating idea that shouldn't you be spending all this money on the poor? No, you've only got me for a while. It's the sort of thing you'd imagine your kind of televangelist who's raking in the millions saying, that, I need my gold-plated Rolls-Royce because I'm only here for a while. How do you square that with the much more sort of activist, radical depiction of Jesus you've been offering us, Giles?
I always hate that phrase. I actually hate that sentence in the Bible. That the poor will be always with us. I mean, there is a... Because it's often used as a form of quietism about poverty, that, well, there's not much we can do about it and so forth. And if you set it against all the other things that Jesus says, which is quite clearly very committed to a sort of preferential option for the poor and the outcast, it seems to me that that's one of those... the Bible is not a neat... it's not a neat and coherent vision of the world, and that's one of those things that just doesn't fit in. I mean, in terms of your using that as an argument and, render unto Caesar and render unto God the things that are God's as a way of separating politics and religion. You see, when Jesus says, give to God the things that are God's, he thinks the things that are God's are everything. I mean, he doesn't think there's a little sphere of life, which is just this little bit, which is for God. And then there's another bit there which got nothing to do with God. He thinks God is in all and through all and in about everything. That's the nature. So actually, he's not talking about discrete entities. Give to God the things that are God. That's the lot.
So why the bit about rendering unto Caesar?
Well, it's just a gnomic statement. He was awfully good at doing these sorts of things.
You got the microphone. The lady wants to come back. Well, because you're in the front row, you're going to get... Is there a microphone here give to our questioner? Yes, yeah, just come back very briefly.
I know this is slightly unfair, but if you go to Paul after him, I mean, he is a classic quietist in saying when these mistreated slaves can go to the synagogue and the temple and get some redress for their bad, for their ill-treating master. When the mistreated slave went to Paul said, authority is God-given, go back to your master. Now, that seems part of that tradition that isn't spoken about, which is the quietist tradition of Christ and Christ made through Paul.
Yeah, Liz is quite right. There is that tradition there, and I think it's rubbish.
OK, that's excellently concise.
I mean, it is there. You're quite right, it's there.
Thank you. And but you say it's the exception rather than with the main thread. Let's hear from you, James Boyes, on this point that the lady there who'd waited patiently said that, you know, sure, you've made a good case for voting Republican 30 years ago, but in just in sheer number of wars, and I know you made a good case that these were, quoting Bob Dole, Democrat wars going back a long way, but in recent years, Iraq, etc., pretty hard to square the peacemaker message of Jesus with the war record of Republican presidents in recent years.
Well, let me see what I can do. I think it's important to recognise that in the United States, church attendance is going through the roof. Christian evangelicals actively support and were responsible for the election of Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, particularly his re-election in 2004. That the Republican Party under the last 30 years has been actively engaged in democratic promotion, in trying to export democracy and freedom to people around the world. You want to talk about wars? Let's address the wars. Where should we begin? What about the Iraq war? That was done very much to try and repel an aggressor from Kuwait, for example, to bring freedom back to a free nation.
You're talking about the recent Iraq war, not the one in 1991. Right, heroic effort, but 2003 is the one we're talking about.
Fair point. It's important. I tell you something interesting. Let's address this. One of the big misunderstandings about American foreign policy is that it's somehow anti-Muslim. The number of wars that have been waged to actually try and free and assist Muslims in, for example, Bosnia, for example, that Bill Clinton launched. It's important to recognize that, I think. It's also important to note that an awful lot of what are referred to as neoconservatives began life as Democrats and left the Democratic Party because they believed that the party had become too politically correct, that it was inherently weak and no longer adequately muscular to support the United States and to defend freedom around the world. So I think that we can certainly have intellectual discussions about the causation for war, but America goes to war to fight for its national interests and peace around the world.
Thank you very much. You're all going to get closing remarks, so make this quite brief if you can, Tim, before we kick that process off. Just on that point that our atheist questioner asked about, you know, isn't this whole thing in a way unhealthy because politics should be politics and keep God out of it?
Christians are commanded to love their neighbours, and if they are somehow asked to keep their faith private and distinct from their political life, it just doesn't make sense. The idea that secularism is neutral, that somehow atheism and an absence of God from the public square is a neutral position, well, most people profess still some sort of faith, even in this country, let alone America. So moving faith out of the public square altogether is impossible. Can I just, you know, on the question of war and military intervention, we all know when wars go wrong and the pain that they cause, but Srebrenica, Rwanda, Darfur, Syria today, the Congo, the absence of actually intervening, the absence of actually correcting wrongs is, in many sense, if you just look at the number of lives lost, where countries like America or our own country have stood aside and washed our hands of it, often the death toll, the loss of life, is greater in non-intervention than intervention. So let us not get into the position of just thinking war is always wrong.
Thank you. We are closing 10 minutes now, in which we're going to hear closing remarks, but you are all going to begin voting. So I will go through the options again. You've definitely heard them, but if you're with Conor Geerty in his argument that Jesus would have voted Democrat, vote Democrat. I think we should have ballot papers coming. You had ballot papers with you. You know what to do. If you are persuaded by James Boyes that Jesus would have, in fact, voted Republican, then use your vote that way. If you believe Tim Montgomery is right and that Jesus would have been a swing voter, then you have that option on your ballot paper. That's the third one. And finally, if you think Giles Fraser's right, that it's none of the above, neither main party, vote there.
Then don't vote.
Or is that the option, David? I think there's a neither main party.
Don't vote. Like, spoil your ballot paper.
Okay. If you can settle down. If you can vote quietly, that would be excellent. You know about a secret ballot. Let's make this a silent ballot. As quiet as we can, because we are now going to have closing arguments. You may want to hear them as you make your final decision. We're going to go in reverse order, following the doctrine of Giles Fraser, of Jesus, but channeled by Giles Fraser, that the first shall be last, the last shall be first. You were the last, Giles Fraser, so you are now the first. From this table, please, a closing 2 minutes.
One of the things that we get to do at Theological College is do this rather silly thing called a Myers-Briggs test, which is a personality test, and you find out what your personality is, and you're given four letters which tell you what your personality is. My Myers-Briggs is ENTP, and you find you're an ISFJ, and these all stand for something. And you do this personality test, and then you're asked the question, before you know the results, which personality type do you think Jesus is? And the extraordinary thing about that test is that the ENTP people all think Jesus is ENTP. The ISFJ people think Jesus is all ISFJ. There's an extraordinary coincidence between what you think you are and what you think Jesus is. And when you see that, you realise that you're constantly constructing this person in your own image. That's what we've had a lot of from the two people on the right here. That I'm a Democrat, therefore Jesus is a Democrat. I'm a Republican, therefore Jesus is a Republican. They're both deeply unconvincing. They sometimes confuse Jesus with Christianity. And the one thing is true about Jesus, if you look at it, he was very, very down on religious people. What he offered was a form of self-critical vigilance, a form of confession, a form of pressure on us to think of ourselves not as good as we would like a politician would present them. No. He wouldn't vote in an election. He wouldn't be a part of this at all. He would be far more critical. He'd be far more dangerous.
Does that mean Jesus would have been quite like you, Charles?
So as you can see, this self-critical vigilance thing just works on so many different levels.
Thank you. That's excellent. Closing 2 minutes from you, Tim Montgomery. Keep voting if you haven't voted. If you have already voted, they will now be being counted in full Ohio style as we speak. So, yeah, Tim Montgomery.
Well, I'm going to finish just by reaffirming that I would still regard Jesus as a swing voter. But I want to conclude by saying I'm happy to trust the American people to make a good choice. We've had a little bit of American knocking in various respects tonight, but I ask some of you to imagine a world where, a different world, a parallel world, where America wasn't actually the most powerful country on earth, that it was China or Russia or Iran. What kind of world would that be? What kind of freedoms would we enjoy? Imagine if the European Union was the most powerful and nothing would ever be done. Maybe that would be a good thing sometimes. Mm. America often gets a bad press, but 70 million people watched the first debate. 55 million people, I think, watched Obama's speech to the convention. 52 million people watched Romney. Have the British people ever sat down and watched Cameron or Miliband in anything like that number? Do you know who is the most generous nation on earth to the people of Africa in terms of private rather than public giving? It is the American people. The American people get a bad press, but actually, who was it who led the reform? Who led the outrage about Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib? It was the American people more than us. They are a good people. We are fortunate to have them in the position in the world that they are. They get a bad press, as I say, but I trust them to make the right decision. And one of the reasons I trust them to make the right decision is although a lot of them follow Jesus inadequately and poorly, Jesus and Christianity is a serious part of a conversation in that country. And I think it is why who they choose, they will make a good decision, if not the perfect decision.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very sort of thoughtful note. You mentioned that 70 million watched the first debate. I was thinking to myself, how many more would have watched if President Obama had turned up, do you think? The audience might have been even larger. Our penultimate speaker, who made the case spiritedly that Jesus would have voted Republican 2 or 2.5, closing minutes from you, James Boyes.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your coming tonight, and I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
One of the points I was trying to make is, to quote Mark Twain, it ain't what you know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And I think one of the problems we face tonight is that a lot of my other panelists have talked an awful lot about religion, but very little about American politics. I have tried to present to you an overview about the true state of reality with regard to the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And I've got to be honest, I've studied this a long time. Some of it amazed me when I was putting this together. I really think that people often say that they don't vote with enough knowledge. I tried to give you some ideas about facts and figures. You've been entertained, moved, quite literally, and sworn at by some of my colleagues on the panel tonight. I really hope you've enjoyed it. I don't think they've adequately addressed the reality of what it means to vote for the Democratic Party, however. And I haven't heard anything that's made me think otherwise with regard to this. I appreciate that, as Tim rightly points out, the Republican Party and many things in America have a bad press. And I would urge you not to go along with what you read in The Guardian every night, but instead to listen to facts, figures, and reality. And I'm happy to put my faith in you, good people, and hope you've enjoyed yourself tonight. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I somehow suspect our speakers have detected that you've already voted and therefore they're not bothering to try and make one last rallying call for their cause. But if you were to do that, Conor Gearty, make one last final pitch that Jesus would have voted Democrat, what would you give us?
I fully intend to. I'll also use the 30 seconds for Gone by James.
basically,
none of us recognise the Republican Party that James described. And that's been picked up on the floor, and it's been picked up here. It's rather sad, actually, because it was such a reasonable case. And I wish the Republican Party were the party he described now, but we know it's not. All the vile aspects of the Democratic Party have migrated to the Republican Party. How would they have felt about this homeless refugee, this single parent, this, as Giles called it, undocumented alien? Well, we know what they would have said about it. Family values? Supporter of Israel? Where would Jesus stand if he went to the Gaza Strip, or he went to the West Bank? Or he went to the occupiers. Which one do you think he'd support? Which one? The illegal occupations or the Palestinians in the West Bank? We just asked the question. There's one error of fact in what was an impeccable presentation by James. The first African-American Supreme Court justice was Thurgood Marshall, who was appointed by a Democratic. And he was succeeded in one of the saddest moments in American constitutional life by Clarence Thomas, an African-American who took the position in the wake of huge controversy about his own behaviour when in office, who was appointed by a Republican, who says nothing, who follows Antonin Scalia all the time. And we just wonder what laughter there was in the Republican Party when they came up with that name to replace a great civil rights man, Thurgood Marshall. Colin Powell has endorsed Obama. I wonder why the senior African-American, apart from Condi Rice, has endorsed Obama. Now, my real opponent today, and you've all voted, is Giles, because he's got a huge number of votes for not voting. Not voting does the work of the right. The right wing opposed democracy for a reason. They saw its potential. The Conservative Party in this country worshipped Disraeli because he showed them how you could still win despite having an iniquitous and unjust system. One of the ideal scenarios desired by the rich is cynicism. And Giles, neither party, etc., is doing the work of capital. He is turning religion into the quiescent thing that he says he deplores. I'll say about Tim, the swing voter, clear policies, of course, are hard to find with Jesus. Of course they're hard to find. Principle isn't, and principle spills into policy. And my very, very last point here is this question that was asked about, is there a Wilberforce? Is there a Shaftesbury? You never recognise them in your own time if you bring the baggage of posthumous adulation to understanding these people. I think fighting his way through the mass of capitalist bias against him, the way the Supreme Court's unleashed the power of capital to try to destroy the party, fighting his way to try and energise a base that he knows, were he to energise them too much, he'd lose power in this systemically right-wing political environment that is in America. We have a man who would argue with Jesus and persuade him about the potentiality of a second term. And I think it would be absolutely clear as day, not in 1860 with the great Abraham Lincoln, not with Theodore Roosevelt with the great parks that Bush tried to destroy in his final days in office. If it was now, 2012, it's a no-brainer. Jesus would be campaigning for and voting for Barack Obama.
who... Thank you very much indeed. Hold on, because I know it's only a matter of seconds till we get the actual result of our vote. Those voting machines are whirring away, digitally processing and counting these votes. So just in the final, I think it's probably 60 or 90 seconds, let's just use our time. Why don't you just come back on that very last point, that it was, that you somehow acquiesce by sitting on your hands in the way you're advocating. And then I've got a question for Tim.
The delightful Conor Gaiety is making a category mistake. I was arguing about what would Jesus do, not what I would do. I would vote Democrat.
Interesting. Okay. Now he tells us you're thinking.
Well, that's I never really did philosophy.
But everybody here has made that. But everybody's made that mistake.
Everybody's made that mistake except Giles.
Because I would vote Democrat, Jesus would vote Democrat. Because I would vote Republican, Jesus would vote Republican. That's the big mistake that's going on here. It's not the case that just because I would vote Democrat, Jesus would. I don't necessarily believe that at all.
And then, okay, my thought that came to mind while you were speaking, Tim, was about the speech that Ed Miliband made, and your answer is going to be very brief because the vote is coming towards me, in which he said, I am a man of faith, even though it's not a religious faith. Where do you think there's any space in British politics to talk about faith and politics? And it's going to be brief because we've got the result.
Yeah, because I think people are fed up with technocracy from politicians. They actually want vision, they want values, they want something bigger than just mechanics. So, absolutely.
Thank you. Good. We have our result before us now. So I will just go to tell you how it was before and how it was now. So when you came in here before, 175 of you said Jesus would vote Democrat. That figure after the debate, I'm sorry, Conor, plunged to 74. But when you came in here, 35 people said Jesus would vote Republican. That figure went up to 38.
But as a percentage...
From little acorns, James, from little acorns. Now, 50 of you said Jesus would be a swing voter. Tim Montgomery, through the sheer power of your argument, you lifted that figure to 56. And 131 of you said that Jesus would back neither party, and that figure swelled on the night to 214.
Yeah. Well, so...
So the verdict of all of you is that your verdict is that Jesus would have voted for neither party. That's your collective verdict. It only remains for me to thank our host, Intelligence Squared, all of you for coming, but finally our panel, Conor Gaiety, James Boyes, Tim Montgomery and Giles Fraser. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can download more Intelligence Squared podcasts free on iTunes and SoundCloud. If you'd like to find out more about our events, sign up to our newsletter at intelligencesquared.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.